Les colloques du Collège de France.
So it's my pleasure to present Dinah Allen, who, like our other speakers, has multiple talents and specialities. She combines her background as an anthropologist with her work as a filmmaker in masterful synthesis. At McGill University in Montreal, where she is associate professor, she co-directs the Critical Media Lab. Her book, or her books, Refugees of the Revolution, Experience of Palestinian Exile, 2014, and Voices of the Nakba, A Living History of Palestine, 2021, are two of the most important works on Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. What I see as most striking about Dinah Allen's contributions is her ability to avoid treating Palestinian populations as mere objects of study, but rather to embrace the empathy necessary for a respectful approach to the other, without compromising the scientific nature of her work. Quite the contrary, I would say. Her work as a filmmaker further amplifies this complexity of perspective. The gaze itself becomes an integral part of everything that, on the path toward the other, is not self-evident, but questions us at the very core of our identity and common humanity. She is one of the filmmakers today who has thought most deeply about how to approach the suffering and pain of others without indecent voyeurism nor superficiality. Her film Partition, to be released in 2026, if I'm not mistaken, or now.
No, it's out now.
Yeah. Pushes an exploration of the Palestinian experience of dislocation, dislocation as a physical destruction at home, dislocation as a life of exile abroad. Her lecture today, beautifully titled in reference or partial reference to the title of Edward Said's autobiography, The Tent Has No Door, Palestinian Poetry in and Out of Place, will undoubtedly further this project. Before giving her the floor, I would like to add that she is the co-founder of the Nakba Archive, a collection of archival images of the first great Palestinian exodus. I hardly need to emphasize, in these times of overt denial, the importance of this project. So please, Dinah.
Thank you very much, Marwan, for that very generous introduction. And thank you, Didier. I echo everybody, my other co-presenters who've sort of acknowledged what an important moment it is to be having a conference on politics and poetics. And I think it's also really, it's wonderful that those two things are combined, because that's often not the case. And I have the misfortune of being on the last panel, and so now I want to, of course, change everything that I've written, having listened to my extraordinary co-panelists. I'm really honored to be here today with you to talk about Mahmoud Al-Sher's poetry, who will be joining us. Sadly, he's not here with us in person, but he will be joining us virtually, and it's really a joy to be on a panel with him, having communicated with him for 2 years via WhatsApp. It's really nice to be in conversation. My first encounter with Mahmoud Al-Sher was in March 2024, 5 months into Israel's war on Gaza, when I hosted a public panel on Gazan poetry. The event centered the work of two poets, Mossab Abtoha and Al-Sher, who both joined virtually. Both poets had been displaced during the first weeks of the war, Abtoha to Cairo and Al-Sher to Mawasi Khan Yunis. Al-Sher explained that poor connectivity after Israel's destruction of the electrical grid meant that he could not turn on his camera. As he read his poems, we looked at the black screen and imagined what we could not see. I tried to visualize the refuge in Mawasi, where he and his wife Hadil and their three-year-old daughter Nay were sheltering, having been forced from their home in Gaza City. Were they there with him as he read to us, an invisible audience on the other side of the world? Where was his poem happening? There or here? I thought about what it is to encounter a person in a place solely through sound. As spectators, we gaze from a distance, but voices in the dark are intimate and immediate. As a way of knowing, listening is embodied and relational. In the darkness, Al-Shaer's poems were a summons. Several months later, listening to another virtual panel on Ghazan poetry convened at Duke by Francis Hasso, I reflected again on world-making in the midst of annihilation. Alaa Naeem Al-Katraoui, a poet and teacher of Arabic language in the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, Ghazan school system, joined virtually from her home in Al-Nusayrat and read poems written for her four children, Yamin, Kenan, Orkida, and Carmel, all of whom were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Khan Yunis in December 2023. I was awed by her presence of mind. John Berger wrote of poetry's continual labor of reassembling what has been scattered. It can repair no loss, he said, but it defies the space which separates. All Al-Katraoui's poems, tender, full of grace and dignity, free of anger, are engaged in the labor of this kind, shoring losses against future ruin. How does one write when death is all around? The poet and scholar Atif Al-Shaer writes that in Gaza, poetry has become a sort of duty, because in his words, it records the last stand of the soul as it stares death and destruction in the face. My talk today centers the work of Al-Shaer and Al-Katraoui, both to honor it specifically and to consider generally how poetry resists the dehumanization of language and thought in a time of erasure. Drawing on the poetry itself and on interviews conducted with both poets in the last 6 months. Perhaps more than any other Palestinian literary form, poetry has challenged cultural erasure, serving as a record of people and places and an assertion of presence and continuity. As an anthropologist and filmmaker by training, I come to this topic not as a scholar of poetry per se, but through my ethnographic work with Palestinian refugees in Lebanon in the field of oral history. In the course of documenting histories of Palestinian displacement and dispossession in the refugee camps in Lebanon for the Nakba Archive, a grassroots oral history collective, we recorded many stories, songs, and poems with first-generation refugees that described lost homes and life worlds. Poetic improvisation is also folded into other kinds of everyday speech. For instance, ataba, a form of lyrical lamentation and longing, will often arise spontaneously in response to events or to mark occasions. It seems to arise from within the singer's body and to form part of a cultural nervous system. These oral forms mean different things in different moments, but are often an assertion of the right to name the dead, to inventory what has been taken and what must be remembered, but also to celebrate and cherish what remains. What does it mean to be a poet in times of war? Asks Hind Judah, the Ghazan poet from El Brej refugee camp. Scholars and writers alike have lamented the failure of words to comprehend the devastation. The illusion that language could be a shield against the monstrous was, for me, among the first things to be shattered and destroyed, writes the novelist Adania Shibli. Language is not immune to acts of genocide and annihilation. It too can be destroyed. Others have reflected on the institutional silence and complicity surrounding the genocide and the reticence to name it as such. An evasive discourse is a contaminated one, and we lose faith in it. Fadi Judah's 2024 poetry collection, which Huda was mentioning earlier, which has for its title only a bracketed ellipsis, points at once to this loss of faith and to regions of the unspeakable beyond it. However we frame the failures of language in the face of atrocity, the fact is that Gaza had gone dark in global consciousness long before October 2023, an intended effect of the blockade Israel imposed in 2005 and maintained for 18 years before beginning its genocide. Gaza has become what Rob Nixon calls an unimagined community, a place of surplus population and administered invisibility. The problem, observes Nixon, is not that such people have been reduced to statistics, but that they have been reduced to non-statistics, a whole different level of dehumanization. Genocide has made starkly apparent lacunae in our knowledge that are systemic and long-standing. Gazan poets themselves confront this sense of linguistic oblivion. Language is dying in me, writes Alshad. I try to write, but fear silences my hand. I try to remember, but everything has been erased. I try to speak, but that there is no language left that can hold the weight of this devastation. And yet, I must speak. I must continue, because silence is another form of disappearance, and I refuse to vanish. We sense his growing despair with words, but also a rekindled faith in them. This pattern recurs in much poetry now coming out of Gaza. When everything is destroyed, food, water, medicine, homes, words can still tell the truth. These were human beings with whole, ordinary lives, Al-Katrawi explained in an interview in October. Alshad, Hinjuda, Abu Toha, Al-Katrawi, Haider al-Ghazali, Hiba Abu Nada, Huda was speaking about, have all in their different ways sought a language that resists erasure. They have turned to poetry as a means for returning feeling and meaning to words, but also as a mode of survival. I am still surviving through poetry and writing, Alshad wrote to me in May 2024. Poetry makes life possible. Many contemporary Gazan poets are bloggers, and most circulate their work through social media and dedicated translation-based platforms like Passages Through Genocide or We Are Not Numbers. With the total destruction of Gaza's archives and cultural institutions, the digital literary sphere serves simultaneously as a space of publication, cultural performance, and conscious preservation, blurring the lines between literary production, political testimony, and digital activism. The poems Al-Katrawi circulates in Arabic on Instagram and Facebook are as formally oblique as they are emotionally direct. If the images suggest that they are often overlaid on images to create a hybrid visual poetics native to the medium. If the images suggest erasure and oblivion, the verses give a glimpse of embodied practices enacted by the community at large, on and offline. The archival forms that will emerge from this genocide are still inchoate, but will include this kind of poetry and this way of sharing it. Alshad, for his part, posts English translations of his poems on his GoFundMe page, addressing the International Solidarity Network sustaining him and his family. In this sense, writing and survival merge directly. His poems on Facebook and YouTube, conversely, are in Arabic and address a local audience, local audiences. Other poets like Haider al-Ghazali and Abu Toha alternate between Arabic and English. Poems in Arabic form part of Gaza's internal dialogue of endurance and grief, while work in English emphasizes witness, justice, and global solidarity. The latter are characterized by urgency and dispatch and are often, not always, written in short lines easily adapted for solidarity actions. A poem that begins on as a Facebook post in Arabic might swiftly be translated into English, reappear as an image, quote, on Instagram, and then resurface in a global solidarity campaign. Al-Ariz, If I Must Die, highlights the viral possibilities of Gazan poetry as witness and weapon. Posted on Twitter a month before he was killed by an Israeli airstrike on December 6, 2023, the poem circulated widely after his death, reaching millions. Like the guiding image of the white kite that flies above Gaza, If I Must Die was swiftly lifted into iconic visibility. It was read aloud at international vigils, held aloft on banners, graffitied on walls, recited by actors, translated into over 100 languages and read over 33 million times, and people have speculated that it may be the most read poem in modern history. As self-elegy, it is both a testament to survival and a call for justice. Its closing lines, if I must die, let it bring hope, Let It Be a Story, reflects on continuity and futurity and physical death as a condition for life in language. Though it became an anthem of global solidarity and resistance to the current genocide, If I Must Die was in fact first published in English on Aleria's blog in November 2011. It was during Operation Carceled in 2008-09 that Aleria decided to address Western audiences directly, convinced that if Palestinians were to gain support for their liberation, they must speak for themselves. His message of unyielding resistance, in a sense, arrived over a decade late. The delay seems significant, underscoring the structural invisibility of Gaza's cyclical destruction. Aleria's poem is a reminder of how Palestinian poetry has always both anticipated and refused death. In a recent interview, novelist and poet Ibrahim Nasrallah reflects, "Perhaps this line of poetry I wrote 42 years ago applies to me now. I write now so that I do not die." Forged in the crucible of exile, Palestinian poetry gives voice to ongoing forms of separation structuring Palestinian life and longed for return. It transgresses and reimagines borders, circulates orally and digitally, and sutures scattered communities through shared recitational practices. In Mahmoud Darwish's poems, exile is both conductor and charge. He writes, "Nothing carries me or makes me carry an idea, not longing and not promise. What will I do? What will I do without exile and a long night that stares at the water?" Exile is both external and internal, is both an external and internal condition, and the poem itself is a place of exile. In a predominantly oral culture, poems transmit not only aesthetic forms, but intergenerational memories and histories, forming what Eric Havelock, the classicist and pioneering orality theorist, referred to in the 1960s as a tribal encyclopedia. Meanings in such an encyclopedia are remade continually through improvisation. Shifts in poetic address capture the changing environments, both of speaker or singer and of audience. The Ataba that I mentioned earlier, sung by elders, recount arduous journeys in 1948 and sometimes evoke the sound and rhythm of camel trains carrying people away from their homes. Place has multiple meanings in Palestinian poetry. It is the lost homeland, the home in exile, the place of the poem unfolding, and the precipitating situation of the poem itself, what American poet Wallace Stevens calls the cry of its occasion. An early epiphany in my own oral history work in Lebanon was that the narratives and memories we recorded with Palestinian elders could not be extracted from the place of the camp. As much as they expressed longing for lost home, they were also embedded within the exilic environment of their recitation, taking form and meaning from the camp itself. Al-Shaal's poems similarly perform a return to his family house in Gaza City, from shifting sites of shelter and expulsion across the south. Over the past 2 years, he and his family have been displaced several times, and in October 2024, his son Mejd had to be evacuated with Al-Shaal's mother to Turkey for critical medical treatment. His poems mark the distance separating family members even as they remake family and home. Erecting poles of memory, they create another kind of shelter for experience in language. In representing displacement, Al-Shaal describes drawing inspiration and courage from Darwish. A year into the genocide, he describes realizing he had, in his words, dealt lightly with our first displacement as a people in 1948, compared to Darwish, who, as he puts it, speaks with a fearless voice and whose fearlessness speaks back to the fear that is controlling me in this current moment. In this same interview, Al-Shaal speaks of choosing between two memories, my memory of the place from which I was displaced and expelled and to which I hope to return, and my memory about displacement and war itself. Al-Shaal is a young but influential figure in Gaza's literary community, known not only as a poet and cultural organizer, but as one of the founders of the literary review Majala 28, in Gallery 28, which is housed in the Al-Hussein Cultural Center in Gaza City, until its destruction in November 2023. Home for him is also the place of reading and writing that renews faith in language. Both the gallery and magazine are named for the 28 letters in the Arabic alphabet. Al-Shaad recalls how he and his collaborators turned the Ottoman-era home built by Shihab al-Din al-Hussein in 1860 into a cultural center in 2021. In the many hours I spent there every week, he explained, I used to imagine the former lives of this building, first under the Ottomans and then the British colonial officials, when it was used as a diwan to meet with leaders and manage local affairs. Al-Hussein House became a gathering place not only for writers but readers, and what Israelis destroyed there was a space of learning, as Al-Shaad puts it. It was an aerial attack on poetry, on voices, and on the greater shared mind that they make. Attack from the sky sears the psyches of those whose bodies it spares. I want to walk, Al-Shaad writes, without the survivor's instinctive glance upward. His poems come from the front lines of dread, studded with terror, claustrophobia, and the paralysis of waiting. They read as if transcribed in real time, their unit of experience, the moment, their pulse and meter, what he calls the breath of deprivation. That he publishes them not in chapbooks or traditional collections, but through social media is driven by circumstance, but the destruction not only of publishing houses, private libraries, and other spaces of learning like Al-Hussein House, but of virtually every brick and mortar cultural institution in Gaza. And yet, in some way, it seems like a choice, perhaps one formally and even thematically appropriate. His poems appear on his crowdfunding page like diary entries or dispatches with a dateline, but no title and little authorial fanfare. He has Mahmoud Al-Shaad, organizer, as his byline. Their contents are a rolling ticker tape of trauma, ready and responsive as an EKG and transcriptive in their timeliness. The one cited above, with the haunting glance upward, was posted the morning after an exceptionally heavy bombardment in summer 2025, one that killed 52 people in Gaza City alone. Even print publications of Al-Shaad's work underscore this sense of urgency, immediacy, and provisionality. His 2024 collection, A Year on the Abyss of Genocide, is presented as a daybook with contents grouped not thematically, but chronologically. The mode of address is intimate and conversational, where the lines between verse, prose, poetry, and journal entry are porous and shifting. The most familiar precedent for this mode of writing in English would be the work of certain mid-century New York poets, in particular Frank O'Hara, with its emphasis less on the timeless than the timely, less on fit and finish of received forms than on agile and spirited improvisation. O'Hara's volumes have titles like Lunch Poems, as in dashed off during his lunch hour, and the almost oxymoronic Meditations in an Emergency. His books are a mainstay both of American popular culture and literary culture and have primed the receptivity of generations of readers to an intimate, nervously alert poetry of the passing moment, a tenuous euphoria in the midst of menace and grief. What makes O'Hara's lightness of being at once so stirring and unsettling is the menace and the moral chaos of its urban American setting. But physical obliteration of a life world is another order of emergency altogether. It is beyond anything seen or imagined in an O'Hara poem. And yet, what the Anglophone reader so often finds in Al-Shaad's work are images of despair, shadowed by an elation, however elusive or momentary. And this sometimes feels like an effect of O'Hara and other poets of the fleeting fragility of life. They've helped us to hear this sensibility. That Al-Shaar is alive and still spiritually whole at the end of each line is the small miracle that moves each poem forward. I want to laugh until the breath of deprivation breaks, Al-Shaar writes in a poem posted on his GoFundMe page on July 14th, 2025. He likens the longed-for peace to a mother's kiss and to wake her child, like the first breath of dawn that cradles a city's face, like birdsong sneaking in through the windows of a house, unhindered by the roar of warplanes, untrapped by military convoys from all directions. The lines are full of imagistic symmetry, fusing the face of a child to that of a city, such that a kiss given to one gives way to breath over the other. The effect is one of imagistic equilibrium, or chiaroscuro. Claustrophobia is offset by sudden release, the siren of an ambulance by that of a song, a memory of loss by a memory of sound, a garden erased by a street remembered. This shuttling movement is integral to a poem so seemingly improvised in form, such that the survivor's instinctive glance upward is inverted by its mirror image in the poem's closing lines. I quote, "A human being who sees his shadow on the ground and smiles in the fullest sense of the word." In a recent exchange on WhatsApp, Al-Shaar wrote, "I believe that writing is an act of personal resistance. Writing," he continues, "is a resistance against forgetting. By archiving my memory in texts, resistance against despair, against oppression, against loss, against humiliation, against hunger, and against the collapse of meaning. Each poem is a profoundly individual act of resistance." The resistance of which Al-Shaar speaks is not only political, mnemonic, and existential, but pneumatic and kinetic. It is felt in his poetry as a kind of line-by-line internal pressure. In Al-Khatrawi's work, we find pressures of a different sort. What animates her poems is not what they respond to mercurially in real time, but what they slowly absorb and are transformed by, the terrible, the beautiful, the prophetic. In an illuminating and moving interview we recorded with her on the 22nd of September this year, she describes her writing process. Faith fluctuates. As the hadith says, it increases and decreases, and with it your capacity to write rises and falls. Yet when you enter that inward, almost unconscious state, I call it turning inward, a poem grows inside you without awareness. Later, when you return to yourself in a calmer state, you find the poem more fully formed. Those experiences store themselves in your unconscious mind and return as a deeper, richer language. There are things I cannot force. Some depths of expression simply cannot be touched at will. Al-Khatrawi has four poetry collections, the most recent being A Tent in the Sky, published by Dar Sod Al-Sabah in Kuwait. As a scholar of both Arabic and English poetry, Al-Khatrawi's influences cut across traditions. Wordsworth's definition of poetry as the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, which takes its origin from emotion recollected in tranquility, is present here. This is wedded in her poetry to a depth of religious feeling that is pervasive and often startling. In this same conversation, she addressed what for her connects poetry to prophecy. I consider writing to be more than the mere ordering of words. These letters and syllables are channels God can use. The Quran itself was revealed through letters. Imagine those letters as living traces. When you reach a certain place, the act of writing moves from the ordinary into something luminous and sustaining. Sometimes you read a text and it leaves no mark. Other times a few words strike you like light. That difference depends on the writer, how they write, in what state, and how they looked at the world. All of that shapes the text. A poem born of sorrow will not read the same as one born of ease. At the heart of Al-Qatraoui's poetry is the complex and radiant image born of sorrow. The process by which it is formed is one she cannot force. It is something akin to the concentric formation of a pearl from a grain of sand or other irritant. I know my mother's mandil has had many uses, she says in her poem titled, I Need That Magic Handkerchief, using the word for headscarf, which in Arabic is also the word for handkerchief. In her hands, the mandil becomes many things, a white flag waved by those exposed to death at checkpoints, a curtain drawn discreetly over the blood of martyrs, a tourniquet that stemmed the wound and soothed the pain, if only briefly, a flag of victory, a cover for the dough to ferment, a mat on which to lay hot bread to cool, a face mask when they bombed us with phosphorus, a winding sheet for dead children, a shawl to comfort their grieving mother. The poem translated by Ismail Al-Jundi concludes with a series of plaintive questions. Did your magic handkerchief help Muhammad play the violin? And was Muhammad happy with it? Was he able to play his first piece after losing his beautiful hand of five fingers? Can a handkerchief be turned into a hand? Can he play a musical note? The poem is not just about the reintegration that follows destruction and dispersal. It is, in itself, the means by which that reintegration is achieved. The living poem sounds what the dead child's hand cannot. What does my tent look like from the sky? Al-Qatraoui asks in the outset of her poem, A Tent in the Sky. Here things are seen from above by birds, invaders, and the dearly departed. All are present in the tripartite gaze of these lines. The tent is a charged image historically. Palestinian refugee camps throughout the Middle East began as tent encampments, hardening over decades into sprawling cinder block neighborhoods. And Gazans repeatedly expelled today huddle in humanitarian zones, tent barracks, where they continue to be bombed and burnt to death. A tent is also the minimal domestic or intimate space, as provisional and transient as the poem that it figures in. There is no door to the tent is the title of another of Al-Qatraoui's poems, also translated by Al-Jundi, which presents an unexpected encounter between old friends, Al-Qatraoui and a fellow UNRWA teacher in the aftermath of tragedy. The women at once reveal and withhold their grief. She did not mention my children again, and I did not ask for details about her home. We avoided looking at each other's eyes the entire time, but we found that in our maneuvering through tears and sadness and avoiding the snares of our words, we had said everything and had wept for everything. There is kindness, discretion, and reciprocity in the furtiveness of that gaze, as well as crushing pain. The tent is the minimal unit of a larger solidarity. It is a symbol of displacement, of placelessness that awaits return, and yet it is the place of the poem, her crucible of creation. It is the other form of homeland for now. It has no door in the sense that it asks not what lies beyond. It is the place of poetry in extremis. One mind less, one world less, wrote George Orwell in 1931 about another context of colonial administered death, a hanging in British Burma. He observed the, quote, unspeakable wrongness of cutting a life short when it is in full tide. We know that what is happening in Gaza is a great crime against humanity, perhaps the single greatest in this still young century. What one knows and feels more fully and terribly after reading the poetry of Al-Qatraoui, Al-Shaer, and other great Gazan minds in full tide is that the genocide is also a great crime against civilization. So many worlds less.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.